Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. This week, Bristol Camera, the campaign for real ale, now spending more time looking after small pubs as well as making sure there's real ale in them. Also Grow Bristol, they're doing urban farming. They were funded by Bristol Green Capital. Annie, having no luck with your doctor? We speak to the Bristol Healing Rooms. And with me now is Peter Bridle. He's the branch pubs officer. Now, what sort of organisation might have a pubs officer?
Well, the Campaign for Real Ale, or CAMRA as it's normally known, has a policy now that we give actual parity to campaigning for community pubs as we do to campaigning for real ale. So this was obviously as a result of the so many pubs closing down the years around the UK.
First of all, what's a community pub?
A community pub, well, I think it's rather one of the kind of the mega bars you get in city centres, which is still a pub. It is a pub that serves a certain community. It can be a business community, a rural community, a suburban community, where there's a regular clientele, basically.
So a free house, maybe?
Absolutely, free house, or even a tied pub. If it's tied to a brewery or one of the big pub companies, they can all be community pubs, but we've lost an alarming number in recent years.
But a lot of people boozing, especially youngsters now, go to these big chains, don't they, in the city centres, and that you could probably go to the same chain in Germany as you could here in Britain.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people's drinking habits have changed radically, and that's just part of the issues really that we're facing.
So you were talking about pubs closing. How many pubs are closing? How are things changing?
Well, we're losing about 21 every week at the moment, and that's down slightly from about 3 years ago when it was 29 every week.
Out of how many roughly, do you know?
Well, I think we've actually seen pubs across the country decline from around 69,000 in 1980 to around 51,000 now. And in fact, just under 1,500 closed last year alone.
So I suppose in about 40, 50 years' time, we might have hardly any pubs left.
Well, if this rate of closure continues, we'll certainly have far, far fewer, and it's a very worrying trend, obviously.
Okay. So why have they closed?
Well, there's a multitude of reasons, really. Clearly, people's habits have changed. There's far more home entertainment these days. There was the smoking legislation, which undoubtedly had a lot of impact on wet-let pubs. Wet-let pubs. So the pubs that really are there for just drinking in. And a lot of those pubs where they didn't have facilities to have smoking areas, they really suffered. Then clearly there's very cheap alcohol you can purchase now from supermarkets. There's the onerous terms that many of the big pub companies apply to pub licensees, which make them unviable.
So what sort of terms are they? I mean, because we always know that quite often landlords, and of course landlords are associated much more with pubs than they are in other ways, they can sometimes, you know, whether you're a poor tenant in a private rented house or a landlord, you might well find all sorts of conditions put on you, especially if you've actually invested quite a lot into that business. And the landlord might say, well, okay, we want you to do this as well, and we won't necessarily get paid anymore for it.
Well, that's right. I mean, many licensees, pub licensees, it's been found, are taking home less than £10,000 a year currently, and clearly that's unacceptable for the hours they have to put in.
Well, I mean, now, some would say, well, they're getting their accommodation, aren't they?
They are indeed, but I mean, it's still a long hours, it's a long week, it's a seven-day a week occupation, very long hours, and a lot of these licensees can't afford to pay many staff or have reduced numbers of staff on now just to make a living. The problem is that a lot of the big pub companies are charging very high rents. They're tying their landlords to a beer tie whereby the landlords can't get their beers from the open market. They have to get them through the pub company at very high prices. So if you're a free house landlord, you could probably get your beer a lot cheaper than if you have to buy it through your pub owning company.
Amazing. I mean, you'd have thought it'd be the opposite way around. So who are some of the worst offenders when it comes to the big chains?
Well, the two biggest chains in the country are Enterprise Inn and Punch Taverns. Now, they own a substantial number of pubs. I think it's probably around 12,000 between them.
So how do we know if we live near one of those pubs?
It's very difficult. They're not normally branded as Enterprise Inns or Punch Taverns.
Well, it's not surprising if they're up to those tricks.
Yeah, I mean, as a result of a lot of these issues, over the last 12 months, CAMRA's managed to get what's called a fair deal for landlords, and there's a pubs company adjudicator now in place. And, you know, we're hoping that once that person who's obviously an MP and a government minister can get their feet under the desk a bit more, then they will actually come down and give landlords a fairer deal.
So it strikes me that over the years, Camera has moved more from actually making sure that real ales are available in pubs, good real ales, to actually trying to make sure those pubs stay open.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have to get our priorities. But I mean, the great news is, from the Campaign for Real Ales point of view, is there's been a boom in new breweries in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, about 15 years ago, there was about 450 breweries. There's now about 1,600 breweries around the UK. The figure's quadrupled approximately. And it's great because most of these breweries are producing a whole range of very interesting and innovative beers. You know,
do you get a chance to drink them all?
I don't drink all of them, no. I mean, I do spend some time in pubs. Some people say I spend far too much time in pubs, but certainly there's a great choice out there now. And if you go around, say, the Bristol area, there's a whole number of good free houses where you can actually get a whole range of really good beer. And it's not just the traditional best bitter. There's all sorts of beer stars now.
So who are the best brewers around here?
Well, we got about 30 breweries in our branch here, and I can't name all of them. I wouldn't like to pick out any.
But can you pick out one or two think are actually been outstanding over the years?
I think one or two that have been outstanding over the last few years are people like Arbor Brewery, who are based in Easton, and the Bristol Beer Factory, based in Ashton in BS3. There's a couple of others as well. I mean, there's several others actually produce very good beer, but certainly we are very well blessed in Bristol, and you'll see their beers in many of the free houses.
I'm going to plug one that I've drunk quite a lot. Which is Bath Ales.
Yeah, Bath Ales. I mean, they've been going, I suppose, over 20 years now. They were taken over about 9 months ago by St. Austell Brewery of Cornwall. Yeah, so St. Austell Brewery, they are keeping the Bristol Brewery open, or I think it's actually in Warmley, not Bristol, just outside Bristol. And certainly they are investing in the brewery. So St. Austell acquired the brewery and the Bath Ales pubs as well. And so they're expanding up this way.
Are any of these places open for the public to visit? Breweries?
Many of the breweries actually do brewery open days. There's a trail around East Bristol. I mean, some of the breweries are based around Easton and Lawrence Hill and around those areas. It's like a mini Burton-on-Trent these days. Burton-on-Trent was always regarded as the brewing capital of England. Well, we've got this cluster of breweries around Easton and Lawrence Hill, and they often have joint open days where you can tour around the breweries.
What about the bigger places like Bath Ales?
Bath Ales, yeah, I think they will probably do, if there's a group of people from, say, a pub who wants to go and visit the brewery, they will do. I don't think you can just turn up on the doorstep normally. But if you want to arrange a tour of a brewery, then you can probably normally arrange it through a pub landlord, particularly if it's a Bath Ales pub.
There's been so many changes, haven't there, in my generation, to the way pubs operate. Now, a lot of children in pubs.
Yes, I mean, this legislation came in about over 20 years ago now, and the vast majority of pubs do allow children in. I think, obviously, some of them have restrictions on the hours they will be allowed into the pub.
And, is it appropriate, do you think?
Well, I think it is these days. I think, we want to encourage people and families to visit pubs as well. I know some people have an issue with it. There are still some pubs that won't allow children in. But the majority, if they're trying to, you know, create a bit of a family-friendly environment and they've got, say, a decent garden particularly, then they will allow children in. I mean, a pub near me in Bishopston called The Annex, they have a superb garden for children, but they have to be out of the pub by a certain, I think it's about 8 or 8.30 in the evening.
Well, that seems to make sense. The planning, you said just before we came on air, you said that actually planning is an issue. Now, in a way, I dread to talk about planning because it can be so boring. But when it comes to getting planning permission, say, for example, to change a pub into a mini supermarket or whatever, surely this is, or even to start a new pub, the planning laws, basically, you live or die by them.
Yes, I mean, it's a complex issue, so I'll try and keep it fairly simple. And basically, there's what's called use class orders. I mean, pubs are A4 use class orders, so if you want to change it into something else. For example, another type of business, and it's another class order, you will have to get planning permission. However, the weakness in the law was if you wanted to demolish that pub, you could do without any planning permission unless it was either had a conservation order on it or it was listed. Fortunately, now, Camera has been lobbying very hard on this for the last couple of years, and legislation has just been passed in the last 3 weeks, which means that all permitted development rights will be withdrawn from July, providing it gets on the statute book, and it seems like it's a formality that it will now. So that now means if any pub wants to change, or the owner wants to change the pub's use for any reason into a restaurant or demolish it, they will have to apply for formal planning permission, so they won't have the automatic permitted development rights any longer.
Now, we did talk about the smoking ban briefly. I mean, what sort of effect has that had? Do you know?
Well, it's very mixed. I don't have the exact stats with me, but I think you'll find a lot of those wet let pubs where there's no food offering, where they are purely drinking pubs, and particularly if they haven't got the an outdoor area at the rear, particularly if they they face onto a high street or main road and there's no outside area at the back, then a lot of those pubs really have suffered, because who wants to, if you're a smoker, I'm not, but if you want to go to the pub and have a few beers, have a few cigarettes with your friends, and it's the middle of winter and it's pouring with rain, you don't want to go out the front of the pub and get freezing cold and soaking wet. So a lot of those pubs have really suffered. It's undoubtedly contributed to a downturn in a lot of the pubs' trade.
Also, a lot more these sort of big screen football pubs now.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, obviously they have to pay for these things if they want to broadcast Sky Sports, but a lot of the pubs do find it worthwhile. Some pubs, found it's not worthwhile. It's too onerous a liability to pay every month. But some pubs, they find it's very successful for them. There are kind of dedicated sports bars. I think the Anchor on the Gloucester Road, for example, in Bishopston, has several big screens, and it's very popular with the customers. So it can work, and some pubs, if they're big enough, they can actually separate out the areas where there's a big sporting event being broadcast, and another area for the pub where people can just have a quiet drink and a meal if they want to.
I'm just speaking from my own personal experience. It's quite annoying when you settle down with a pint and a few friends and suddenly a football match starts on the opposite side of the pub.
I know. I think once you get to know your local pubs, or you can go onto various websites like Cameron's own website, What Pub, that will tell you what facilities are available at the pub, and you can actually see if there's likely to be a sporting event on that evening before you go out and choose your pub carefully.
Sounds like a really good idea. Have you got quite a big presence on the web? And what about something you could use on your mobile phone, because you seem to be pretty much up with the times.
Yeah, well, Camera certainly has obviously a national website that's got lots of information on it, different links from the homepage. Our own branch has a website as well. Camera also obviously it produces its famous flagship publication every year, The Good Beer Guide. We have that in hard copy form, but also app form as well. So you can
have it on your phone then?
You can have it on your smartphone, that's right, indeed you can, yeah.
And what would you be able to do with that? When you open your app, what can you do?
Well, you can find out all the pubs near you. You can just literally, if you're in some part of Bristol or anywhere in the country, you can literally click on it. It will show you the nearest Good Beer Guide listed pubs to you, and then it will also show you the nearest other pubs in ascending order from where you are. So, that pub's like 5 minutes walk away, another one's half a mile away and whatever. So it's all very up to date, really.
Fantastic.
We've actually just had our Camera Bristol Beer Festival, and we even had an app for that, actually, for our beer festival at Temple Meads Passenger Shed.
So how did that go?
It went very well. It was sold out. We had it, it was 2 weeks ago, and we opened on the Thursday afternoon, closed on Saturday night, and it was sold out. It was a terrific event.
So
very popular.
How many different brews were there?
I think we had about 140 different real ales, plus about 40 ciders and perries. This is all real ales and natural cider and perry, which is the pear equivalent of cider. So it's made from
and
pears.
In what sort of setting? You're in the passenger shed. That sounds quite posh.
Well, if you know Temple Meads, as you walk up towards Temple Meads up the incline, it's on the left-hand side next to the car park. There's a big exhibition hall there, and we held it there. And we've held it there for several years now, and it's very popular. It always sells out in advance.
And so you come in, you pay your whatever to get in there, and you're in the passenger shed all day and all evening?
Well, actually, it's so popular now you have to buy the tickets in advance because it sells out. But once you get in there, we have two sessions each day. So you come in, you can be in there for, say, about 11:30 through till 4. I think that's enough for most people, actually. We're not seeing, everyone we've spoken to, all the feedback has been very, very positive. It's a very relaxed, event. People who appreciate good beer, or perhaps people who are new to good beer or cider for the first time, they find it a very enjoyable festival.
So I suppose you better get on the waiting list for next year.
We put all the information on our website well in advance on Bristol Camera website, so that's always worth checking out from time to time.
And is that your only big event of the year you do?
Well, as a branch, we do lots of things. We lobby our MPs, like we did recently on the planning issue. We produce a magazine every quarter called Pints West. That's it's just won the National Best Camera Magazine Award last weekend.
Oh, well
done.
For
about the fifth time in the
last
few years.
What sort of stuff's in there then?
All sorts of things. Pub news, brewery news, details of all our events and so on and so forth, what's going on in the national scene, without being too dull, but we obviously sometimes report on things like national legislation that might impact on pub users.
No, good. I mean, when you say lobbying, how do you actually do that? How do you persuade an MP, twist their arm? What, do you buy them a pint?
No, well, we actually meet up with MPs occasionally, and we've met up with MPs in Westminster itself, but also in the local surgeries in Bristol and the surrounding areas. So if it's things like, you know, beer duty, we had a very successful lobby on beer duty back in about 2013. We had over 1,000 members from around the country went to Westminster to the House of Commons on a certain day, and we all met up with our MPs.
So what is beer duty?
Beer duty is a tax on beer, fundamentally, and we pay far higher, about 10 times higher than most other countries in Europe. We pay about 10 times more than Germany. Now, you always associate Germany with beer, and UK, our national drink, alcoholic beverage, is beer. Yet for some reason, in this country, we are paying 10 times more than Germany. And that also applies to most other countries in Europe. They are also paying much, much less than the UK.
Well, Peter, it sounds like a bit of a racket to me.
It is. I mean, I think in this country, beer has always been a soft target. I mean, the last government, under the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, he actually introduced what was the dreaded beer duty escalator, and that was a 2% increase above inflation every single year.
Oh, no.
So we were getting a bit fed up with that in camera because it was destroying pubs, it was hitting consumers in the pockets. So we actually had this big lobby in Westminster around 2013 after the new government had come into power and said, look, enough is enough. This is just pricing people out of pubs.
Okay. Is there any way to set up the situation as it is to encourage new pubs starting and to help small pubs carry on?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there. There's the new business rates, which we're lobbying on now because the new business rates have hit many pubs very hard. We may have heard about them about a month ago. A lot of businesses have had substantial increases in business rates. We've managed to get concessions through for many community pubs, but not all. But the new phenomenon, the very positive thing, is the new wave of pubs, which are called micro pubs. There's now about 500 in the country. We've only got two in Bristol so far, but they are proving to be very popular.
Okay, where are they?
The first one that opened was in December 2015. It's a Draper's Arms on the Gloucester Road in Horfield. And the second one that opened just over a year ago is called Chums in Chandos Road in Redland. Now, the great news is, actually, the Draper's Arms actually just won our branch pub of the year about 2 weeks ago. So it won the Bristol and District Camera
Amazing.
Pub of the Year.
Yeah. And how big is it?
Oh, it's tiny. It's not much bigger than this studio, in fact.
Really? Like, so you've got literally maybe you can have 10 people in there.
I'd say about 30. Okay, perhaps it's three times the size of this
yes,
studio.
I think it must be.
But they're very simple offerings. They're going back to the old ale houses, really. There's no electronic entertainment. Lots of them don't have any spirits. No, like keg beers. That's the processed fizzy beers. All they have on is real ale or cask ale, as it's also known, and conversation rules. And they're great. And there's about 500 around the UK. It only started about 10 years ago.
Okay, just remind us where those are, because I think of our listeners might well like to just pop in, you know, these. Because they're kind of out of the way a little bit, aren't they?
Yeah, one was out the road. I mean, there's plenty of buses up and down the Gloucester Road. So the Draper's Arms is just down from the Memorial Stadium, the Rovers Ground, the Memorial Stadium, and it's on the same side. It doesn't look like a pub from the outside much, so you have to keep your wits about you. But
is there a landmark sort of?
Well, there's the old Queen Vic pub, which is actually just closed, apparently, diagonally opposite.
Oh, no.
And also a Shell petrol station, also diagonally opposite. So that's where it is. It's the top end of the Gloucester Road. Well, when I say the top end, you know, for Bristol, really. It's just down from
before
the men's
stadium. Before you get to Filton Avenue.
Just before, about 5 minutes walk down from Filton Avenue.
Right, okay, so we've got
on the
that
left,
one.
On the left-hand side. Now, just be aware, the pubs are normally open until 5 in the evenings, apart from weekends.
Oh, okay. So on the weekends they're open till?
Well, on Saturdays they open, I think, lunchtimes. But again, on Sunday they don't open until later. So be aware of that. Check out their website. The other one that opened just over a year ago is called Chums. It's in Chandos Road in Redland. And experienced licensee Mark Farrell opened that one. And that's also going very, very well. And it's great. And encouragingly, there should be a third one opening soon. It's just going through the planning process, and I'm not sure what it's going to be called, but it's on Fishponds Road, so we should have our third one fairly soon. So that'd be three opening within about 18 months.
Amazing. Can I ask you, I know it's a bit cheeky, but give us your four favourite pubs in Bristol. So if, you know, it might be that, you know, these favourites change from time to time, from year to year, but it would be nice to just, you know, if one of these places is near us, I think people may want to pop in.
Well, I think it's fair to say that, yeah, you're right, my favourites do change all the time, and although lots of pubs have closed in recent times, I wouldn't say these are my four favourites, but these are four of my favourites, shall we say, then. The Lime Kiln on St George's Road, which is behind City Hall, which was also known as the Council House until about 3 years ago, it's a great little plain boozer, really. You go there for a beer and maybe a little bit of music on the jukebox. A very well-run pub, a great licensee called Paul Ratton, who won several awards, young guy, when he was at the Seven Stars before from Camera for a great beer. beer. It's a genuine free house, no permanent beers on at all on the real ale front. All the beers, all six of them, are forever changing. And he has a variety of beer styles on as well. So I think that's a great pub. So the Limekiln, it was known as the, I think it was called the, oh, I think it was the Horse and Groom before, until about 2 years ago when it reopened. But a very good pub indeed. The Cornubia in the middle of Bristol, opposite the Central Fire Station, that's a great pub, full of character, very old building, listed exterior, very cosy inside. Bit of an eccentric landlord. I don't think I might be saying that. But yeah, again, great outside area as well when the weather's good as well at the front of the pub, right in the heart of the city, but rather just tucked away a bit of a hidden pub. And I think also in town, I do like the Bridge Inn and the Seven Stars. There's a couple of pubs very nearby each other. The Bridge Inn's right near to the Central Health Clinic on Passage Street, another free house, and the Seven Stars, a great pub with a real history to it. It's a fairly basic pub. They won't mind me saying that, I'm sure, but it dates back to the early 1600s, and it's survived everything, including the Luftwaffe and the Second World War. And it's got a connection also with the abolition of the slave trade, because one of the main men in the abolition of the slave trade, Thomas Clarkson, came to Bristol and teamed up with the landlord there to do a bit of undercover research about how these people in the slave trade were getting people to get coerced them onto the ships to take part in the slave trade. And
wow.
He was a leading light, Thomas Clarkson.
Bit of history.
In the abolition of the slave trade.
Fantastic.
The connection there with the Seven Stars. So that's worth checking out as well.
Yes. Well, maybe there should be a statue to him somewhere in Bristol.
Well, there is a plaque outside the pub, in fact.
Yes. Well, yeah. Let's have a little bit more. Maybe a slightly bigger one than Edward Colston.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Anyway, so you said earlier that you do events and things like that through the year. Is the beer festival the only thing? So I'm thinking, hang on, we've got all summer and all autumn now. Are you arranging anything else for the rest of the year?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. It's all on our website. We have a branch diary page link from our homepage on the Bristol Camera website. But we have also...
if people want to come along and drink beer and talk beer, is there anything that you're up to?
Yeah, I mean, we have all sorts of events. We have pub socials, we have brewery visits. We go out to the country to our outlying areas by minibus, because none of us wants to drink and drive. Well, we wouldn't do that anymore, would we, of course? So all sorts of things. We have a branch meeting. We do brewery tours. It's a lot of fun as well. We do our bit of campaigning as well with the local MPs and councillors and so on and so forth. But we do have a lot of fun. So if anyone wants to see what's going on in the next few weeks, go onto the Bristol Camera website. Just type in Bristol Camera into Google or whatever and click on Branch Diary, and you'll see a few events coming up.
Your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Other ones are available, yes.
Yeah. And what about you, Peter? What first got you so enthusiastic about pubs and
booze? My wife told me I should get a hobby. Anyway, that's another story. I've always liked... I mean, when I was young, I drank lager. I drank other sorts of beers and all sorts of stuff. After a while, I was living in London at the time and actually came across one or two pubs and some camera promotional materials, some magazines at the time. And I thought, well, this sounds interesting. And I had a colleague at work who was in camera. So I thought, this sounds interesting. And eventually, after a couple of years of procrastination, I actually got round to joining at a beer festival, and I've not looked back since. I've been actually thoroughly enjoying it. And the local branch now has over 3,600 members. We are the fourth biggest in the country, and it's an all-time high. Cameron nationally has got 187,000 members. That's an all-time high as well. So it's all, from that point of view, it's all going very positive. From the beer point of view, the big threat we have at the moment is to our community pubs.
Well, God help the government if they start trying to take our community pubs out. I imagine your 187,000 will be at their throat. Oh, no. They'll be lobbying them.
Well, we have done a lot of lobbying over the last 3 or 4 years, and we have had several successes with our governments.
Give us an idea. So that's really good.
The scrapping of the beer duty escalator, like I mentioned earlier, was one of our biggest successes in recent times. We actually managed to get that. Not only was it stopped, the 2% above inflation every year on beer duty, that was stopped through our hard lobbying. But then for 2 years after that, they actually reduced the beer duty by each budget. So that was a bit of a success. It's unfortunate that the current Chancellor just put 2p on a pint in the last budget about a month ago. And equally with this things like the pubs code adjudicator, we managed to get that position in place to try and get a fairer deal for pub company landlords. And as I say, the most recent success in the last 2 or 3 weeks was the scrapping of automatic development rights for pubs. So that should be coming into effect on the statute book from July.
Fantastic. Well, Peter Bridle, you're the pubs officer, which is a wonderful post to hold in the Bristol branch of Camera. Thanks very much for joining
us. I'm also the membership secretary, so if anyone wants to join the national website, just £25 a year.
Thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm joined by Dermot O'Regan, who's a co-founder of something called Grow Bristol. When it sounds, is Bristol getting bigger?
No, but it's getting bigger in our field, which is vertical farming.
Now, look, vertical farming, just a minute. I know what you're doing is urban farming in Bristol. So what is vertical farming?
Well, Grow Bristol started about looking at how we could grow fresh, healthy produce, food in the city. And to do that, obviously, you need, there's not a lot of farmland, there's not a lot of soil, and there's limited space.
Well, so, hang on, there's plenty of allotments.
There's plenty of allotments, but we're looking at trying to get to a commercial scale production of really fresh, healthy food.
Yeah, I always wonder, I look at allotments sometimes and I think, were these designed so that you would never actually be able to turn it into a market garden or something a little bit, you know, to money-making?
Yeah, and market garden is the term. Could we kind of call what we do a new kind of market gardening? Because in the old days, just around the edge of Bristol, people would grow food for and sell it locally into the local market. Now, there's lots of allotments, but you have 10, 20 people on allotment and they're all growing their own little thing.
Well, I can remember as a Londoner in the 1970s, we would quite often stop on the fringes of the city, pop into the local market garden and get in. And I've noticed as well that there used to be a whole kind of setup that the government had, really post-war, where you could get into farming bit by bit. So you'd start off with a little market garden, then you could have a small farm you could even rent from your local authority. And if you liked it, you could do it. But that's all gone. Most of those, I would say almost all of them, have been sold off now, those farms, into, you know, commercial products. They're not owned by local authorities anymore. So how can you do anything up to a scale of a market garden, which is, I don't know, maybe a couple of acres, on little patches of land in the city?
Yeah, so what we've done is we've thought, well, look, we can't grow in soil and we need to grow in a new way. So what we do is we use hydroponics, which is soilless growing. It's used on a big scale to grow tomatoes and things in massive greenhouses. So we grow in hydroponics.
Yeah, your problem is, of course, you've got lots of contaminated soil here in the city, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. So how can we do it? This vertical farming is about using hydroponics, and also we grow indoors in a controlled environment, and we use lighting. So basically what we can do is we can stack layers and layers of crops up within a building or a space and have a very high production, but also a way of quite clean production.
But hang on, I mean, what about all the electricity to power these light bulbs?
So, I mean, the first thing is we are plugged into the, and people often look at the energy, but what we look at is the total carbon footprint of our food. So food has a very high carbon footprint in the way it's grown, with a lot of farm machinery and pesticides and so on. But also that food then gets transported long distances, perhaps from overseas or within the UK. Then it gets stored in big supermarkets, and then people drive to the supermarket and come back. So that ends up very energy intensive, very carbon intensive. However, growing food right next to the point of consumption, like we do, we grow our food and then on the same day or the next day it's delivered to the customer. We're cutting out all of the distribution and the storage and the high energy costs.
So where do you find your spaces to grow this food? And so, you're talking about almost exclusively indoors?
Yes, at the moment. I mean, it is flexible. We could be looking at rooftops and so on. But at the moment, we've started out quite a small scale in shipping containers.
Wow.
So we've basically got us. We're on a bit of disused industrial land near Temple Meads, overlooked by the old Royal Mail building. And we plonked a couple of shipping containers in, kitted it out with our little vertical growing system, and we managed to produce 20, 30 kilos a week of the healthiest, most local, freshest greens that you can get in the city.
How can you grow food in a shipping container? You can't turn that into a little mini farm. And anyway, if you were to grow in bulk, you'd need hundreds of them.
Well, one option is to sort of have more shipping containers, but the other is to start growing within buildings. Perhaps we could look at, in London, there's a couple of bigger projects than us. One are in a big warehouse. The other are in tunnels underneath the tube station. So it's about you being really innovative and using big spaces to put vertical farms to grow really fresh local produce.
So once it's grown, whereabouts do you sell this, and where can we buy it?
So half our stuff goes to restaurants. So we're the nearest one to us. We're in central Bristol near Stokes Croft now. We're in the Canteen, for example, really popular cafe restaurant.
Okay, what are you selling to them? So where am I going to find that in my sandwich or in my meal?
Well, what you'll have is we sell them pea shoots, for example, incredibly fresh, healthy, lovely tasting pea shoots, and they buy radish leaf. So that's one of our products that's really popular. It's really a small leaf. We call it a microgreen. But it's got an intense flavour and an intense look. So it's often...
Sounds nice. My mouth is watering, actually.
Well, I've got some here if you want to taste.
We'll have to do that afterwards.
So basically what we provide is very small greens with very high impact in terms of their look and their taste. So they add it, chefs love to add them to their dishes to complement the taste, but also that they look great. And we also sell in a lot of Whole Food and greengrocers around the city, a kind of mixed salad, a superfood salad, we call it.
So will we know when we're buying something that you've grown it?
Yeah, we're really big on, so we mark up the, if you go into the restaurant, a lot of them like the Canteen and some of the other restaurants like the River Cottage and so on that we supply, they really are big on advertising where their produce comes from. So we often appear on their menus or on blackboards where the produce comes from. If you go to some of the shops we produce, we deliver to, we have nice labelling, and the labelling says the date it's been picked, and so people can see that it's really fresh.
Lovely. What about how you're funded? I mean, surely the money's got to come from somewhere to buy these shipping containers, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we started off really small. We actually got some funding from in 2015 from Bristol Green Capital. So we got some funding, and that helped us to develop the site and to buy in some other systems and also run some educational programs around what we do. But since then, we've started to try and build – we want to build a sustainable business, so we don't want to be reliant on grants or volunteers. Our aim is to grow soon to a stage where we're actually self-sufficient as a business. So we're a social enterprise, which means we do educational stuff and have volunteers and help people out, but actually we need to be self-sufficient.
Now, I'm
ourselves.
Thinking about places like Waitrose, these kinds of big supermarkets, big outlets, but they charge quite a lot for the vegetables. I mean, surely if you're growing the right stuff and it's really good quality, organic, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Is it organic?
It won't be certified organic because the systems we use, hydroponic systems, aren't allowed to be certified organic. However, I call it beyond organic because we don't use any chemicals, any pesticides, whereas some organic food does allow a certain amount of pesticides. So we think that certification's not the big thing. It is more or less organic, but we like the fact that people can trust the farmer. They
but
can come and see us.
Don't you have any trouble with pests, though? I mean, at all?
In our controlled environment, we try to keep them out, but we have had, for example, a problem with some fruit flies recently. Mm. So what we use instead of pesticides is what they call biocontrol. So we find other organisms.
I'm thinking, I might be stupid, but put a big lump of jam in the corner and those fruit flies will go.
Well, we do something similar, actually. We do use sticky pads, and then we have a fly attractant. But also we use things like mites, predatory mites. So they go into the system and they scurry around and eat the flies' eggs and then dissipate without causing any need for nasty chemicals.
Well,
to
that's out. Pretty
It's much
small.
More kind of like biological. It's more of an ecosystem. Although we're quite high-tech, we're actually using sort of biological controls that you would have more in nature.
And you're looking to expand, aren't you, really?
Mm. Yeah, so we've been really successful. I mean, in our short time selling for a year, we're selling to about 30 different outlets. And at the end of last year, we won the Bristol Good Food Awards Best Grower, Best Local Grower.
Right.
So people are really interested in the story. We provide training for volunteer opportunities. So we think we need to get bigger. So,
well, yeah. And most also, if these top restaurants are coming back for more, it must be a fairly strong sign that you're doing it right.
Yeah, we can't keep up the demand, to be honest. So that's not a bad problem to have if you're growing a business, that you can't keep up with demand. But the obvious thing is to grow a lot more and sell a lot more. So we're looking at the moment to work with more people. We need another piece of land, maybe a big building or some land where we can put some more containers.
Okay, well, if anyone has a piece of land or knows of a piece of land or a building, what sort of thing are you looking for?
So, yeah, we're hopefully be quite central because part of our unique approach is that I deliver everything by bicycle myself. I've got quite an awesome electric trike that I load up. So we're able to cut, given that we're so close to customers.
Right, so you don't want to be out in Whitchurch or somewhere like that.
We don't really want to be out in the sticks. So it's really good to have we're currently on a piece of land that had a wood yard on it and was knocked down. So we're hoping there are pieces of land that would be sort of vacant and not being productive, and we can move in on them, largest piece of land, half an acre or whatever, that we could move into and make productive and grow really fresh, healthy local
food. Now, would the idea be that you want to give it a go for free for a while, and if you can start making it productive, then pay rent, or what was, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Yeah, sometimes people have land that they want people to do good stuff on, and they might give you preferential rates. So, yeah, land can be important, but I think there are bits of land still around in Bristol that we think people might be interested in working alongside us. You know, if you're building housing on a land, why not have an urban farm on it as well, where the people who live there can not only benefit from eating the produce but help grow it?
Yeah, well, it'd be nice to think we had the developers in the city that would be so forward-thinking.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's proven that when you grow stuff, you feel better, you know, whether you grow it in your backyard. So I think introducing all kinds of green spaces and growing and so on into where people live is a no-brainer, really.
So, Dermot, how do people find you? How do they get in touch?
Yeah, so we have a website, www.growbristol.co.uk. Probably needs updating, but we do use social media a lot, so Facebook and Twitter. There's a lot of information there. There's a lot of pictures about what we do. We have open days at the weekends, so people can come and see the system. And they can also buy our produce at various places, including a really nice initiative called the Food Assembly. I've just come from there, the Eastern Food Assembly, where people shop online, quite a powerful shopping online experience, but then they get to meet the producer. So we go to Eastern Community Centre, and then the customers come and collect from us, and we get to meet them. So it's kind of combining the power of internet shopping with the old school markets and farmers markets.
Well, it sounds a bit like a farmers market. Surely it must be worth your while to turn up there.
So yeah, we it's like a prepaid farmers market. So we go there, we're there every week. So anyone can join the Food Assembly and shop online and then get to chat and meet the producer.
Fantastic. Okay, just remind us a couple of places that people can go and actually buy or eat your food.
Yeah, so we sell to a lot of sort of high street greengrocers all over, like North Street, Ashton Fruit Shop, Chi Whole Foods near Temple Meads, Mabel's in Redland, and Source in St Nick's Market. And then also lots of restaurants like Bocca Bar and Canteen and Old Market Assembly and Old Bookshop on North Street. So all points you can find us. And on our website, we have a list of all the places you can eat and buy our stuff and lots of nice pictures.
Well, lovely. Dermot O'Regan from Grow Bristol, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm joined now by Lynn Weaver and Dave Coates from Bristol Healing Rooms. Maybe you first, Lynn. Where are these healing rooms and what do you do there?
The healing rooms at the moment are in City Road Baptist, which is just up the road from here.
So you say at the moment, do they move around?
Well, we've not that long started. So,
oh, okay.
Perhaps that's not a good expression.
Okay.
So what we do is we, on a website, we will give the hours and the times that we're there, which at the moment is on a Wednesday. And then people will maybe phone us up or tell us they're coming. Other people will just drop in. And then we will give, there's a team of us, and there will be quite a big team, so there'll be different people at different times, and then we'll sit down with two or three of us with one person and pray with them and so, give them probably as much time as they need.
So don't people get this kind of thing in church?
Well, in some churches they do. I think in a lot of churches, my experience in the past on other teams has been that people would come down, especially when I worked on the street teams, people would come down and say, would you pray for us because we don't get this in our church? So I think in lots of churches they do, but equally in lots of churches they don't.
So tell me about those street teams. What were you doing there?
We put out a set of chairs that was called Healing on the Streets, and we were just, people would know we were there. We had a banner which said healing, and we would just speak to people coming by. We had leaflets. If people didn't want to engage with us, that was fine. We'd invite them to sit on a chair, and we would pray for them.
And any success?
Yes.
Go on then, tell us how, if you, I mean, because a lot of people are very sceptical about this kind of thing, aren't they?
Okay. Well, I believe that the Holy Spirit does heal, and that comes through Jesus. So we would pray very simply, and we would welcome the presence of the Holy Spirit, and then we would just speak to the disease or whatever it was the person had talked to us about. But people will come with very different things. So they might have mental things, physical things, emotional things. And I've seen all sorts of things happen. I've seen people get off chairs and say, my back is fine now, and it wasn't before. They could hardly move. I remember one of the traffic wardens coming in and asking us what we were doing on the street. And so we explained, and she said, oh, I've got trouble with my foot. So she sat down on a chair. We prayed very simply for her. She gets up and walks around and says, wow, that is so different.
So you're talking about instant, really?
Well, that case was. I would say that doesn't always happen. Sometimes it will be some relief, and sometimes people won't know at all. And sometimes we won't know at all. But I can give you an example that sometimes people come back. So one day I prayed for a little girl who was about 6 months old, I think, or maybe a bit younger, and she had eczema. So she was in a pram. Mum just said, didn't know we were there, but when she found we were there, she said, would we pray for her? So I prayed for her. I didn't see anything change whatsoever. So I could have thought, and I probably did think at the time, well, nothing happened there. But about a year later, she comes onto the street again and says, and I just happened to be there. And she said to me, do you remember me? And I said, no. And she said, here's my little girl. And she said, 2 weeks after, so this was a long time later, 2 weeks after you prayed, her skin was clear, and look at her now. So people would often come back and say, I've been healed, or I've had this much has healed, even though it's not all healed.
Dave, what would you say to people that say, well, that maybe that would have cleared up anyway?
So, yeah, some things it's difficult to know, but we know that there are some cases of healings where the hospital has given not a very good prognosis, or the, for example, I prayed for a lady who had diabetes and she broke her leg and the bone was pinned. So they'd fixed the leg, but it wasn't healing. And the wound in the leg wasn't healing, and it was weeping and getting manky. And the hospital said, we're a bit worried about your leg, and we think, you know, if it doesn't start healing quickly in the next 2 days, we'll have to amputate it. So there was nothing really anybody could do about that. And the lady was quite panicky, really. She came and asked us to pray for her. And, in fact, me and another chap, we went and to her house, prayed for her. And from that moment onwards, it just cleared up. And she, you know, the wound scabbed over, it stopped weeping. And it just healed, and she didn't have to have her leg amputated. So that's a sort of classic healing type of thing, as opposed to a miracle where, you know, get instant.
Well, I'm sure you've seen these films like I have in the US, for example, of these so-called healers that have been actually exposed as frauds as well.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know anything about that, but I do know, I mean, I've been involved in healing for most of my life. I've seen lots of things, and we've started up in the healing room in Bristol in the last few months, and we've seen lots of healings. Somebody came in who had an excruciating knee, and there was nothing much they could do, probably other than a knee replacement. And she came in, and we prayed for her knee, and we said, "What's the pain level?" It was like 10 out of 10, you know. And as we prayed, it went down to 5, and then it went down to 0, you know. And she said, "Wow, that's amazing, you know. I can't believe that. It's just literally..." In fact, it happened on the other night as well, a lady with 2 hips really agonising, and the pain completely went. But the first lady, she went out, and she was so amazed that she started getting people off the street to come in. She saw somebody in a wheelchair and said, "Oh, you ought to go in there, because I just got healed. You know, my left knee, which was agony, just got healed." So we know that people are getting healed of things which aren't easy to sort out medically. But we're not guaranteeing, we're not saying that in every case everyone will get healed of everything. But we do know that, because we believe that, you know, everyone that came to Jesus, when, you know, people came to him, everyone was healed. And of every, you know, there wasn't a single exception to that. So we, you know, we believe that the same happens, that, you know, people that come to Jesus can be healed.
I mean, could you, for example, do you think you could heal a Buddhist, an atheist, or even a Satanist?
Yes, we had a situation the other day. One of our friends was praying for a lady. She was a Muslim, actually, and she was hobbling in the street. He went up to her and said, "Would you like us to pray for you?" And she said, "Oh, yes, please." And she, as they prayed, her knee was completely healed. She had a stick, and suddenly she didn't need the stick anymore, and she walked off holding the stick.
Now, you've just reminded me, because several... nurses in the National Health Service have actually been sacked for offering to pray for people. That doesn't seem like that fits really with what you're saying there.
No, I mean, in the 1950s, I've recently seen a picture of Leeds Royal Infirmary of about 8 nurses all kneeling down around a table in the ward praying before the start of their shift. So the original origin of hospitals was actually that they would pray, and, you know, there was a Christian theme there.
Well, of course, originally they were kind of in the before Henry VIII, they were monasteries, weren't they? Lynn, do you think there's actually a place for this kind of thing still in our hospitals?
I'd like to see a day when that came. I used to be a nurse, but at the time we wouldn't pray with patients in the days when I trained. But I think we also need to honour, I think, what happens in places. So I wouldn't want to bulldoze into a hospital and actually say we need to pray with the patients, because I think we need to honour the people that are there and then be given permission to go and to be able to do that. So I think a day will come. I believe a day will come when we'll be able to do that.
You could be right.
That'd be great.
And also, I mean, it just seems to me strange that such a fairly simple alternative therapy is not available as part of the health service. It just doesn't seem... I mean, surely it's not going to hurt anybody to have a go.
It isn't. I think some of the situations were conversations, some of them were praying for people. I think, I suppose, to go back to what I said before, really, I think if I was working today and wasn't allowed to do that, I would honour that and do it in other places.
So why is it, do you think, that it's been sort of shoved out from the health service and a kind of official hospitals?
I think sometimes people don't understand. People sometimes are frightened because... what to me... So I've prayed for the sick for quite a lot of years now, so to me that's more normal, but I know for lots of Christians even that isn't normal. So I think it's a bit scary sometimes if you aren't used to that.
How did you get started here in Bristol then? It's only very recent, isn't it?
Yeah, so there wasn't a healing rooms in Bristol, so and there's... a National Association of Healing Rooms, England and Wales. And so I got to know the local area people, and we decided to see if there were people who would be prepared to you know, from across the churches who are involved in the healing ministry who would like to join together and form a healing rooms ministry. And, the, you know, in fact, there are at least 20 people that wanted to do it, so we formed one with the blessing of the parent organisation.
Do you have any sort of public presence other than in the Baptist Church, is it, in Bond City Road, is it?
Well, funnily enough, we were out on the on Broadmead on Sunday. We, because it was Palm Sunday, we were out there. We had some worship, and we were praying for people out on the square there. So we do go out quite a lot as well. So we have
did
a base.
Any, did you get any customers on Broadmead?
Oh yeah, yes. Yeah.
We prayed for about 30 yes. people, I think.
Yeah, we prayed for quite a lot of people and encouraged people. I had a lady who came to me because I'd said something about people. I don't know if words of knowledge makes any sense to you. So that just means the Holy Spirit is telling us something. So I felt there was somebody had pains in their legs, but actually they it was more about God noticing them that they needed, because there was some emotional stuff going on. So this lady comes to me with her legs partly bent already. She just was moving quite awkwardly. So I prayed with her, and I found out afterwards three other people were praying with people who had got leg problems at the same time. She had some healing, but not total healing. I would protect what the lady said to me, but she had some quite awful things spoken over her when she was very small, and that had caused her a huge amount of pain. So there's an emotional thing going on there. So I was able to help her, pray with her, and with her permission, hug her for a bit, because some of that is part of being kind to somebody.
Amazing. But, you know, still, I suppose the obvious thing here is, well, you know, is this ethical and is it right when, for example, some people would say, well, actually, what you're doing is you're proselytising or kind of preaching at people?
I suppose that depends how you are. And I suppose I would never bulldoze over somebody. And I would always ask their permission. So when I was with this lady, I said to her, did you understand what I was saying before, after I prayed for her legs? So I prayed for her legs to start with her permission. And then I talked to her and asked her, and then she gave me the information.
Now, I'm going to be a bit cheeky now and say, look, when the Holy Spirit is talking to you, how do you know? How do you hear?
So, well, now you've heard my voice. If I phoned you, you would probably recognise my voice. So I practised over the years listening to God speaking to me. So when the Holy Spirit speaks to me, I tend to know. So because I've had a bit of practice, but years ago I would not have even thought about it.
I suppose it's about taking the time to tune in, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Anyway, Dave, so just remind us about whereabouts you are and, you know, how people can find you if they want to. I just do think it's, you know, surely if someone's ill, it's worth a shot.
Definitely, yeah.
Yes.
There's absolutely nothing to lose at all. We totally respect the medical profession as well, but, you know, there's no harm in praying.
And do you charge?
No, we don't charge. So we operate in City Road Baptist Church from 12 till 3:30 on a Wednesday currently. We're also likely to open in Wesley's Chapel in Broadmead in May, when the conversion of the refurbishment's finished. And we may also have other places where we operate. And then every now and again we go out on the street. We were out in the Bear Pit this morning. So sometimes we will vary it, so we're in different places. But that's our base at the moment.
Have you got a phone number or people contact you online?
Yeah, there's also an online website, so the best thing is to go onto that, which is www.bristolhealingrooms.com. And then all the opening times are going to be on there. And there's also a phone number, which is 079 000 55392.
Just give us that number again.
079-000-55392.
So, Lynn Weaver and Dave Coates from Bristol Healing Rooms Group. Not just the rooms, it's the group that counts. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much.
That's all for this week. Thanks to our guests. That was Peter Bridle, who's the branch pubs officer for Bristol Camera, the campaign for Real Ale. Dermot O'Regan, who's one of the co-founders of the Urban Farmers Grow Bristol. And to Lynn Weaver and Dave Coates from Bristol Healing Rooms. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Go to www.dialectradio.co.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
year we get a gospel dance record as good as Sounds of Blackness's Optimistic or this one, Lisa Taylor's.